All right, and we're back with our midweek podcast roundtable, whatever you want to call it. I don't have an official name for it. I just call it the midweek podcast, and I'm here with Joshua Cutchin and Red Pill Junkie.
Good evening.
We could call it a cabal.
Ah, it's the secret cabal of the where did the road go? I was almost just said things that didn't apply to this show. I almost said the last exit for the lost, and that's totally not this show.
The last exit on the road that is going somewhere.
Yes, exactly. You know, it was totally not my intention to have two shows whose name work together. Mm-hmm. As of today, I've been doing The Last Exit for the Lost 22 years.
Wow. Congratulations. That's awesome.
And that's as of June 3rd when we're recording this.
No, I can't imagine sticking with anything for 22 years.
And when I did Where Did the Road Go, the name came up totally separately, but it's kind of interesting that on WVBR, where this the main show airs every week, it's Where Did the Road Go into The Last Exit for the Lost.
Well, I love both names, you know. They're symbolic, they kind of like mysterious, and it's all about kind of like they convey the sense of the journey, right?
It's sort of like the
destination. Yeah.
Sort of like where the sidewalk ends, you know? That sort of idea of the mystery beyond.
Yeah. Huh, there's a name for a show, Where the Sidewalk Ends.
Bigfoot at the curve.
Maybe that should be the round table. It's Where the Sidewalk Ends.
Nice. Okay.
Anyway, tonight we're gonna kinda hit a starting point and then we're gonna go from there. And two nights ago, I did a very long interview with Jeff Ritzman, who is currently doing Paratopia Oculus. And Jeff has had some really weird experiences in his life, and that will be airing over the next couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. But one of the things we talked about is a project he did before called Project Core. And I think I actually submitted to this, and I didn't make the connection until he was talking about it a little more. But what he did is he collected a bunch of stories from people who had paranormal experiences, and it didn't matter if it was a Bigfoot encounter, a ghost encounter, a UFO encounter, or just something else entirely. Just something unexplained, different, weird, paranormal, however people wanted to consider it. And then he had things like, what's your heritage, what's your blood type, and other questions like that. And the goal was to at least start some sort of a, to see if any patterns emerged. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, and I never saw the results, and right now the webpage is down. He is putting it back up. He's just moving servers with it. But I said, well, did you find any patterns? And he said, well, sort of. He said, I found that a lot of people with German heritage and sometimes English heritage have these experiences. He said it happens a lot with people who have very high IQs. Mm-hmm. And he said there was one particular blood type, but he couldn't remember what it was. And the thing that stuck out to me when he said that is that in David Politis's work of people missing in the wilderness, you find out a lot of times it's people with German heritage and people who have extremely high IQs. Mm. And that just seemed like a very weird thing to connect like that if there isn't something else to it.
Let me ask you, did David Politis also find some kind of pattern with regards to the victims or the missing people's bloodline?
I don't think he has any way to check the blood types.
Okay.
He did, though, I recall, make some connections with German heritage, did he not?
Yes, well, that's what I'm saying. German heritage and high IQ are the two things that they both found, both the Project Core and in David's work. And it's not exclusive. It's not only people with German heritage. Mm-hmm. But there's an overwhelmingly high amount of people who have German or English heritage that have these experiences. Incidentally, I have German and English heritage.
What's your blood type?
I don't know.
Rh negative? Do you remember if that was the blood type, perhaps?
I said that he wasn't really sure.
Okay.
He didn't want to say because he honestly didn't remember.
Mm. Okay.
And I know Rh negative has some weird things. Go on, Josh.
I was just going to say that was the whole basis for Nick Redfern's.
Yes.
Not his latest book, because he's put out five since then, probably.
Right.
I think it was Bloodline of the Gods, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is talking about how people tend to either be interested in or experience paranormal phenomena, especially UFO phenomena, if they have Rh negative blood type.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it could be. When he puts it back up, hopefully some of that data will be there. But as he pointed out, this was a very informal sort of thing, Project Core, yeah. Because he couldn't go out. You know, someone could say, yeah, I have a really high IQ.
Mm-hmm.
But do they? And he said, you know, the other thing is try to find two, you know, experts who will agree on what constitutes the best IQ test.
Yeah.
Right.
But, you know, you can tell if people have been in gifted and talented programs and things like that, they probably have higher IQs.
Yeah. The only problem, too, is that I see that maybe a project like that might sort of self-select by virtue of the way that the information is transmitted and the audience that it's reaching. You know, you're not going to find a bunch of sub-Saharan bush people sending in, you know,
fair enough.
Traveling to a library and sending something in to the internet website for Project Core.
Yeah, and also applying an IQ test on a sub-Saharan bushman, you know, it's quite tricky.
Right, because sure. They're, you know, if you're living in that environment, intelligence is a completely different thing, I think.
That is correct. But
yeah, I mean, there's no real reliable way of measuring intelligence, I don't think. I mean, there are smart – everyone's smart at something.
I think Project Core was about trying to measure things that are really hard to measure, you know. Like mm-hmm. all these – I mean, experience with the unknown. But I really believe these guys did a what you guys call a yeoman's work in trying to get the ball rolling and really try something different. And, well, yeah, and I mean, that is commendable, incredibly commendable.
Yeah, I see it's worth the worth of Project Core almost as being more of like a postmodern paranormal, you know, a information gathering project. Yeah, because, you know, let's take this, let's deconstruct this, see if we can find a new way to collect that in the first place.
And it's interesting to see, you know, whether the big data approach could also yield interesting results in things like the abduction experience.
Yes, exactly. I mean, is there a pattern? And if there's a pattern with this stuff, why?
Mm-hmm.
Politis, I mean, and the thing is, that also draws a connection between missing people and paranormal events potentially as well. I mean, it's always been in speculation that these really weird disappearances could have be paranormal in nature, but you can't prove that. There's no evidence to support that.
Yeah.
There's just questions. But when you know, Politis. Some of his patterns, of course, like I said, with a German heritage, high IQ, but at the other end of the spectrum, also people with learning disabilities and stuff like that, the elderly and sometimes the infirm would also go missing in the same way.
Yeah.
It was the people in the middle that didn't seem to have a big cross-section. It was either really in shape, smart, or really infirm and having trouble taking care of themselves, like children or whatever.
I mean, it's interesting because, right now I'm thinking of this anecdote. I don't really know if it's an urban myth or not. They say that Albert Einstein always had to ask for some police officer to remind him where he lived because he actually kept forgetting mm-hmm. his home address. So that tells you something. I mean, being incredibly smart, you know, very intellectual, also renders you become incredibly incompetent in things that quote-unquote normal people will find easy.
Absolutely. It's almost like a form of autism.
Yeah.
You know, the social world, the social workings, the simple things are just beyond what some people are able to deal with, but you give them something complex, you give them a thought experiment, and they're gone.
Yeah, exactly. And sorry, Josh, go ahead.
No. I was just going to say, this sort of gets to another thing that I'm thinking of, too, is if you're looking at these demographics, if you're looking at these particular categories that people fall into, it may not be that the paranormal happened to reveal themselves to people of certain IQs or certain races, it might be that people of certain IQs or certain races might be more open to certain experiences that are attached to the paranormal. Like, you know, if you know, for example, going back to the heritage thing, maybe there's some sort of disease or syndrome that people of German heritage are more susceptible to, and that's the thing that is the light for the moth, so to speak. And I wonder if that's sort of what you're getting at here, is that people with different skill sets and different ways of viewing the world are not what attracts the paranormal to them, rather than actually just the fact that they are that way.
Could be. And I was thinking along those lines, sort of the light for the moths type of a scenario, if maybe there's something in the bloodline of certain German and English people or something that stands out to things that we can't normally see. And if you're in the right place at the right time, you show up when other people don't. The other interesting one that Politis had discovered is a lot of people had certain ailments like diabetes or something like that. And I actually said to him, look, you know, I'm diabetic, I'm German and English, and I have a high IQ. And he went, maybe we should lock you in a bank vault.
Just don't go in the woods anywhere, Soraya.
Yeah.
But I've had really weird experiences in the woods where I felt like something was following me.
Okay.
Really, really creepy sort of things. It was the one Potter's Field we used to hang out on the edge of all the time. We had walked deeper into the actual field, and there were areas where there were old Jewish graveyards, very old Jewish graveyards. And they were covered in trees and weeds and stuff, and they just weren't taken care of at all. I mean, it must have been ages since these things had been taken care of, because you could barely even see the graves in there. And you could walk around them, and that's where the Potter's Field's off to the right, and there was a small path on the left as you walk around this sort of island of a graveyard. And my friend had walked around to the right, and I had walked around to the left, and I stopped, and I suddenly got that Oz factor. And all the sounds went away. Everything just disappeared. And I got this horribly creepy feeling like there was something coming down on me. And I looked around. There's nothing around. I'm like, I think I'm going to go find my friend. Like, I wasn't quite scared, but it definitely felt like something wasn't right.
Of course. How old were you?
Probably around 17 or 18.
Okay.
So long before any of the missing 401 stuff was around, obviously.
Sure.
And I've had that experience numerous times in the woods where things suddenly just get very quiet and very eerie. Not to mention something following me around my property at one point.
And yet you keep returning to the woods.
Right. And I don't know. And other people have that experience. I mean, that's not a unique experience of that Oz factor in the woods where everything suddenly goes dead quiet. So why do some people not come back?
Well, and here's the other thing, too. Maybe it's not the phenomena being attracted to a demographic, but a demographic continuously putting itself in the way of the phenomena, like like you're going back to the woods, you know?
But it's so hard to put a finger on, because, I mean, it's easy for someone to say, oh, aliens are taking people or Bigfoot's taking people. We don't even know what that means. I mean, we have conceptions of obviously what aliens and Bigfoot are, but we don't know if they exist. We don't know if they do exist, what they are exactly. So to say then that they're taking people is kind of like making a few huge jumps in logic.
Well, you know, and I've joked before in the past about how I'm like, no, it's fairies taking people. And really, right. that's the power of the missing 411 stuff, is that it is pretty much a paranormal Rorschach test for people to put their favorite theory onto. But the reason that I keep on returning back to fairies is I feel like that still keeps it sort of a vague answer. For me, that's more of like a elemental earth spirit sort of, you know, possibly no, it doesn't exclude aliens, doesn't exclude Bigfoot. It just says some sort of it's intelligent non-human presence is what's doing it. And that's sort of where I keep on coming back to.
And that makes perfect sense to me, especially when you see that some of the stuff David has picked up also, like Boulder Fields being a place for disappearances or reappearances and stuff like that, are the same stuff you hear in the folklore of so many people around the world.
And mm-hmm. I would add that in Western culture, when we think of fairies, we think of mostly archetypes coming from two main cultures, English or, you know, British Isles and Germanic cultures.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
I don't think that that's really coincidental in a lot of ways.
No.
What we were talking about before we started this, Josh, the Expanded Perspective show where they talked about trolls.
Yes.
And, you know, they're reading these different stories of people in Norwegian areas that had encounters with trolls.
Mm.
And, you know, I'm listening to these, and all that's coming to my mind is this is just another version of the fairy faith.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And again, they live in boulders, or they you know, live in boulder fields. And I know in Iceland, there was issues with them building roads because they would have to destroy these large boulders. And the people were like, you can't do that.
Yep.
You know, the elementals live in there.
Well, and you look at the people who still harbor these beliefs around the world, and there are people who are still very much in touch with and very much at the mercy of their environment. You know, Iceland's famously a population that really does believe in the huldufólk, the hidden folk, and
right.
They are isolated on basically clinging to this rock in the middle of the North Sea, or North Atlantic, perhaps is more accurate. But you know, is it any surprise that people in the inner city or in rural small communities don't have any feeling for this? And yet again, when people go into the wilderness, when they get back in touch with that, that's when people end up disappearing, like in David's work.
And also, and I'm going to have Steph Young on again soon to talk about, well, now she has two books to talk about, but her mm-hmm. not latest one, she talks about this Malaysian legend of the whispering people. And these are the people who live in the woods who steal people away.
Doesn't sound creepy at all.
Yeah.
No, not at all. The tales she has in the one chapter of the whispering people are so freaking creepy. And it's people going in and getting lost on trails that they've been on before. They have no idea where they are. And they can wander for days, and suddenly they just wander out as right where they thought they were before. Mm. But yeah, the whole whispering people thing is kind of the fairy faith and the aliens, I guess, of our culture coming down and taking people.
And yet, I wanted to interject here to something Joshua mentioned about people who were still at the mercy of nature, you know. And the minute he said that, I something in my mind said, well, aren't we all actually at the mercy of nature? We may delude ourselves into thinking that we're not, you know, in our big modern cities, you know, here in Mexico City, where we every 2 days or so we get into emergency mode because the pollution levels get so high that, you know, people can't go into the street.
Oh, man. So, but you also have earthquakes to remind you of nature.
So the thing that I find so fascinating about Iceland here is this is a country with a really high standards of living, and mm-hmm. they still seem to try to work with nature instead of like against it, you know, like there's some kind of like, I don't know, symbiosis or strength of synergy between human culture and these forces of nature, which, you know, in their culture they are represented in the form of these the hidden people, you know, whether you want to ascribe that as some kind of like psychological construction or maybe some kind of like cultural thing in order to try to instruct people or to acclimatize people to follow certain rules when they're dealing with nature, or maybe there's some kind of non-human intelligence that we don't really have an understanding of how it works, but we decide to treat them with respect nonetheless. And I think we all tend to lean towards that explanation, but nonetheless, I feel that that is kind of like the way we should still be trying to live in, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, I agree.
Yep.
I agree completely.
I mean, I always think of, you know, the idea of the planet as either, you know, we're an infection in the planet, and either the infection dies or the host dies, you know?
Yeah,
that's sort of a thing.
It's always thing people talk about the end of the world. It's like, you know, chances are the world's not going to end. We may end,
yeah, exactly.
But you know, the Earth is probably still going to be fine.
I just to sort of piggyback on that quickly on that whole Icelandic thing. There is a documentary that's available on YouTube, which the actual title it's a French documentary of folk belief in Iceland, and I'm not going to try to pronounce the French title, but if you just type in elves, ghosts, sea monsters, and ETs in Iceland: investigation into the invisible world on YouTube, it's a wonderful documentary. It's about 90 minutes or so, and it's really, really quite enjoyable. I found it subtitled, but it's got some great stories in there.
You should post that to the Where Did the Road Go Facebook group.
Maybe I will right now.
And then when you hear this later, you'll know why he did that.
Well, and what I like too about the whole fairy thing is that it can be literal, if you want to say that there are these small, separate, discrete intelligences, or it can be actually a metaphor for some sort of greater, almost Gaian model that's doing something as well. You know, some sort of respect for the Earth as an entity.
Mm-hmm.
And like I've pointed out, what amused me when I was watching a couple episodes of Ghost Adventures is that they pick up these things on the motion sensitive cameras there that they come with the Xbox. What's it called?
Oh yeah, the Kinect.
Kinect, yes. And they'd pick up these small figures, and they'd be able to sense something at the time they're seeing these figures, assuming that, you know, always have to have that great assault that anything on television could be fake. But I don't know that they would necessarily fake small figures. I think if they were going to fake something, they would try and create something more typically ghostly.
Yeah, normal size.
So I think the fact that they had these small creatures and these things were climbing the one guy, which was easily the funniest episode, was the thing was climbing up the side of them. They're not saying anything, and they're just like, oh, my God. And he's going, what's happening to me? I feel like something's on my head. And they're going, uh-huh.
Is that clip available online? You can actually see
I believe so.
Nice.
I think if you search YouTube, it was at one point up.
And now Soraya is going to upload that to the Facebook page.
I don't know where it is. You'd have to search for it. Okay. Search for Ghost Hunters and Little Figures or something like that. I'm not sorry, not Ghost Hunters, Ghost Adventures.
Let's see, Ghost Adventures and Little Figures. All I'm getting are a bunch of Hummel figurines, so that's apparently not.
But, you know, and again, but they're small, and it's like, okay, so what is it about small?
Is it, are they small, or are we large? Uh-huh.
Well, that could be too.
Or,
as
the book by Ivan Wendt said, you know, they choose to be either small or large as they see fit.
Well, that could be too. The Bigfoot is the large version of the fairy.
If I really wanted to go like all sophomore level philosophy college stoner on you, I could say, well, you know, if the universe is expanding and they're ancient spirits, then wouldn't they naturally be smaller than we are?
Interesting.
Small or far away.
Mm-hmm.
There was some theory, and I'm trying to remember what it is. Oh, it's going to drive me nuts because I can't remember the details, but it was something like that. Like the Earth is constantly getting smaller or bigger, and so is everything else, and everything else is expanding at the same rate. So it looks like we're not actually getting any bigger, but we're constantly getting bigger. I listened to this whole theory, and I just went, I can't disprove it. It's nonsense, but I can't disprove it because of the way they stated it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know,
because the idea is that everything was getting bigger at the same time so that everything stayed relatively the same size but was bigger than it was before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the internal logic sound, I guess.
Sure. Can't disprove it.
You know, I think though, my personal opinion on why these things always tend to be smaller or larger, because you look at a lot of the contactee literature, a lot of the older UFO literature, you had giants coming out of craft and stuff. Very, very rarely are things like, you know, as they are in terms of, you know, being human sized. And I think that whatever it is wants to make it obvious that they are the other, you know, that they are not us, you know, maybe.
Yeah.
Or maybe because we are seemingly co-creating some of this stuff, we're intentionally making it seem smaller so it's not as threatening.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point.
Because giants are scary.
Yep.
Yeah.
Whereas a little person is kind of like, am I really seeing that? Is that real?
Although I remember, you know, seeing or reading the abduction literature and the idea of small 3-4 foot tall entities creeping into my bedroom terrorized me, you know.
Mm. Sure, but would it be more frightening if they were big, huge creatures coming into your bedroom?
I don't know.
I think them being smaller is scarier for me.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, like, well, there's an old TV movie called Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, where there are these tiny entities that are attacking people. And there's that great episode of The Twilight Zone called The Invaders. And I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's for the same reason that I can't handle rodents. I can handle bugs because I can kill bugs with a Kleenex, you know.
Yeah.
But if I have a mouse in the house, I can't kill it with a Kleenex. So I don't know what to do.
And if you can, that's impressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the same reason why in Jurassic Park the velociraptors are actually scarier than the T-Rex, because they are human sized and they can't get into the same rooms, you know, the same human sized rooms. As the characters, you know, in the movie.
Fair enough.
Yeah, you always know where the T-Rex is, usually.
Exactly.
And if you don't, then you really need to worry. Sooner or later, we'll have real dinosaurs.
Probably.
I keep hearing from different sources, and I don't know if it's true or not, that gravity must have been different at the time.
Oh, my God. That wasn't the thing that Jose Canseco tweeted, you know.
Huh?
Jose Canseco tweeted that a couple of years ago.
So someone, I think one of the guys from the Electric Universe, the mythologist there, name is on the tip of my tongue, not Wallace, his partner.
I do know that there's a guy.
David Talbot.
Oh, that's right.
Because Talbot, I think, was talking about saying that if gravity was less, this would explain dinosaurs because their massive size, our science says they would collapse under our gravity.
Yeah.
But, of course, we also don't understand how bees fly.
Mm. Yeah, you know, I've heard that as well. And I heard that that's like something of an urban legend, that there's actually... It looks like it shouldn't, but there's actually something subtle where we do know how bees fly. But having said that, there are plenty of other things that we don't understand and don't know how they work either.
We don't know how gravity works anyway.
There's a guy who's big into this. It's the idea is the expanding Earth theory. It's that that's why there was continental drift. Is the Earth was like a shell and then it expanded, and that's the reason that the continents spread apart. And there's this guy whose name is Neil Adams, who's a comic book guy who's also on the side is really into expanding Earth theory. He was on the Grimerica podcast a while back and talking about this. And that was what he brought up was the idea of the dinosaurs.
Well, maybe this is what I was talking about earlier. It was a takeoff of that.
Yeah.
The expanding Earth theory.
It sounds a lot like the same thing. Yeah.
Hmm. I mean, I don't know if that's true. I don't know if we would know if it was true until we create one and see what happens.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I feel like there's so many. We were talking about the gray basket earlier before we started recording. There are so many of these things in these fields that are outright goofy, but there are enough anomalies to support them that you have to really go, well, there's something that isn't fitting with the current paradigm there. I don't think that that's the right answer, but there are enough clues that we should probably reevaluate what we think about the past, at least a little bit.
Well, you figure we don't have any large land animals anymore. I mean, the biggest ones are, if I'm not mistaken, the biggest ones are probably elephants.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, we got blue whale and stuff in the ocean, but they're supported by water. Why did we lose all these giant animals? It seems like no matter what kind of cataclysm came across, they should have redeveloped at some point.
Well, it takes millions and millions of years, you know.
Well, there should have been some survivors.
Well, they say that woolly mammoths were still roaming the Siberian tundra when Egyptians were building the first pyramids.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, mammoths were larger too than elephants as well.
Yeah, not that much bigger.
Yeah, not that much bigger. But I mean, and it's enough that you would look at it and go, "Damn." Yeah.
Well, you look at the number of large animals, even large mammals that existed right at the end of the last ice age, and you know, I mean, yeah, okay. So if we got hit by a comet, like many people think we did, it could have wiped a lot of them out. But it seems like some of them would have gotten through. Some of them would have survived somewhere.
Yeah, you know, it's...
Everything seems to be getting smaller over time, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And maybe there's nothing to that. Maybe there's perfectly good explanations. Or maybe there has been some shift in gravity that makes it less good to be big.
Well, you know, that sort of reminds me of is insular dwarfism, which is the sort of also called like the island rule, where whenever animals are on an island, they tend to grow smaller and smaller to preserve resources.
Well... So, maybe we could apply that logic here. I mean, maybe animals tend to be larger back in ancient times because there was more energy in the form of, I don't know, plant matter and food stuff that will allow, you know, such an increase in size. But as time went by, you know, the energy, you know, in form of food became scarcer, therefore, you know, things started to become smaller, you know, in order to compensate. Or maybe it's a matter of, you know, increasing in numbers of populations.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about this concept of things on islands getting smaller is that it really is everything trying to reach an equilibrium. So what you end up having is you have larger species on islands getting smaller over time and smaller species getting larger until there's sort of this equilibrium which is reached, which we kind of in some sense, when you mentioned like our largest animals, in terms of the mammalian type at least, it feels like we really are sort of almost at that equilibrium right now. I mean, things are all... There aren't huge, vast differences. Like, well, I guess mice versus African elephants, but
we do know that in the age of the dinosaurs, the atmosphere was quite different. You know, the oxygen levels in the air were higher. You know, so mm-hmm. these big saurians, you know, the dinosaurs, they didn't have actually that big of a problem in trying to get, like, things like metabolic processes, you know, breathing and all that. I remember reading in the original Jurassic Park novel how, you know, all the people who went and visited the first Jurassic Park when they still was, you know, testing them, they saw, you know, a triceratops and seeing the poor animal like wheezing, you know, really hard because obviously it was an animal that had been designed to live in a completely different atmosphere. And now it was as if a human was trying to breathe, I don't want to say Mars, you know, but maybe on top of Mount Everest.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, okay.
That's certainly one way to think of it. I mean, it definitely does imply that there has been some sort of environmental change, whatever it may be, that allowed species to grow more robust. I think that's a fair statement.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So yeah,
I'm processing all of that.
I think it's about filling niches. You know, I mean, you know, there's the whale shark obviously is so large. It needs to be so large because it spends most of its time, you know, filtering foodstuffs, you know, through its mouth. You know, it's like a sure. giant vacuum, you know. And,
well, if I'm not mistaken, people are actually getting bigger.
Yeah.
I seem true. To remember reading that, you know, back in the Middle Ages, the average height was far less than it is now.
No, that's true. And you visit any historical sites, and generally speaking, the door frames are a good deal lower as well.
Hmm.
So, I mean, we're grown. Of course, then there are also the tale of giants.
Yeah, true.
Whether or not, you know, and I feel like we've found enough skeletons, even if we can't, you know, if the Smithsonian has whisked so many of them away, it seems like there's a good chance giants existed at one point. Whether or not they were just human anomalies or a slightly different offshoot of human or not, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm open to that possibility.
But, I mean, you have stories, just like little people, you have stories of giants all over the world. I think the difference is these, you know, the giants aren't necessarily imbued all the time with the same type of paranormal powers. A lot of times they were just leaders of tribes and stuff.
Well, which we're still doing today. We give the little gray aliens supernatural powers and we say, no, Bigfoot, you don't get any.
Hey, some Bigfoots have supernatural powers.
Oh, hey, you're preaching to the choir here.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there may be both things. We may have a physical Bigfoot out there and something that's mimicking it that's paranormal based. And even if we discover the physical one, that doesn't explain the people who have had paranormal encounters with Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, I can. Hey, I bang the Bigfoot's not as clean cut drum enough as it is.
Yeah.
I think Patrick Harper said Bigfoot's just a big hairy daemon.
Yeah, it makes as good a sense as anything for me.
Not demon, for anyone who may have misheard that. And that's another problem. People jump so, you know, if you have that type of upbringing where things are religious and everything that doesn't seem good is automatically demonic.
Mm-hmm.
In the latest interview I did with Patrick Harper, I got a couple of comments, you know, someone saying that the one eye on the cover of the book was satanic.
Well, you know,
and it's an owl's eye, of course, an owl, because owls are everywhere now.
Right.
Thanks, Mike. but, you know, it's like I'm thinking, it is? Okay. What?
Well, you know, when you only have a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Exactly.
Yeah, I guess so. but it's just, and of course there are plenty of people speculating that missing people are being taken by demons or whatever, and then it morphs over into aliens, and you know, aliens are demonic and this and that, and it's like, this is not constructive. If we want to figure out anything about what's going on, that's not the way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we go back full circle to Project Core, because, you know, I think one of the most interesting things they tried to enforce or to try to practice in that project was not to label things, you know, not
yes.
to say, well, we're going to make this arbitrary distinction between alien abduction cases or demonic visitation cases or fairy folk, you know, encounters. You know, they would say they didn't concern themselves with trying to put these artificial labels. They were only trying to gather data, and after they got the data, they are start trying to parse through it and starting to see if there were any interesting correlations or patterns, you know. And I think that is the right way to do things, you know, that is
yes.
actually the scientific way to do it. You know, obviously the project had huge limitations because it was conducted by independent layman, you know, and a couple of scientific advisors, but obviously they didn't have the kind of resources which would have, you know, amounted to a more meaningful or more valuable, you know, conclusions. But that wasn't the point. The point, I think, was, you know, I think that was what they, Ritzman and his collaborators, you know, Jeremy Bainey, Tyler Cochran, and a few others, they wanted to try to show that it was possible to try to create such a project, you know, such a data gathering endeavor in this field.
And the thing is, he said, I believe they had 250 people input data.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a counter argument might be, well, you know, what if these people were lying?
Mm-hmm.
But I would think the more data you got, I mean, the people, I'm sure there are people who could just make something up and put it in there and just be like, well, I'm just going to screw with them. I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Or do it because they feel it's all nonsense, so they're going to add more nonsense to it. But I would think that would be the minority. And I think the more people you get inputting the data, the more those anomalies are just going to go away.
Exactly.
Well, and that would be an interesting sort of, not really control, but a sort of interesting way to make sure that we, that sort of, well, I guess maybe sort of a control, would be to have another test group and, you know, hire them basically, tell them, try to give me the most convincing, you know, alien abduction experience that you can come up with.
Mm-hmm.
From what you know of. You know, someone not interested in the subject, from what you know of, tell me,
and then see how close they get.
Yeah, see how many overlaps there are.
Yep.
I don't think that there would be a lot. I think that you get some stuff. I think that you get a bunch of the theatrics. I don't think you'd get, you know, a gray alien coming up really close in your face and projecting love. You know, I don't think you'd get.
No, you will probably get the generic, stereotypical gray alien with the big black almond eyes.
Yep.
You know, because that is part of the culture. But when you get the really outlandish stuff, you know, like, I don't know, hairy dwarves or the gray alien being accompanied by your dead grandma, mm-hmm. that is the kind of stuff that really stands out. That is the kind of stuff that the late Carla Turner pointed out as being probably the best way to try to really start to find answers into this phenomenon by focusing in the things that really didn't make any sense at all.
Yeah, the high strangeness
the
stuff
high
is the stuff to pay attention to.
Yeah.
Because if someone has a UFO encounter and they give you the most stereotypical abduction account, and everything fits with, like, everything you've ever seen on TV.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want to call the person a liar, but I'd be like, all right, this almost sounds like too perfect to, you know, what you would expect if you didn't know any better. Mm-hmm. It doesn't prove that they're lying. They may not be. Maybe the thing about these phenomena is that the trickster runs through it.
No, the trickster, and also the fact that people try to interpret their personal experience through a certain cultural lens.
Well, I'm not going to talk about this part or this part because that's crazy. I'll just tell them the part that they think that you want to hear.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
And I think you have researchers out there who will. Well, I know you have researchers out there, especially in UFOs, who will just clip out the stuff that doesn't fit their criteria.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, this is what's happening. Well, I don't know what to do with that stuff over there, so I'm just not going to bother mentioning it. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you get it in cases of everything. You probably have people who are researching Bigfoot who believe it's a flesh and blood creature, and when someone tells them, you know, about something really weird and paranormal that happened during their Bigfoot encounter, they just kind of gloss over it and keep going. Not because they're dishonest, but because their brain there says, well, that part's just in their head.
Yeah, that's what David Jacobs, though, do when he encounters things or accounts that don't agree with his particular interpretation of the phenomenon. He says, well, that is confabulation. That's actually the term he uses.
Yeah, and even worse than that are the ways that people will completely, you know, bend over backwards to account for anomalies in some of these encounters. Like, you know, for example, you know, Bigfoot tracks it in a field. Well, he's, you know, he must have covered up his tracks, or mm-hmm. Bigfoot suddenly disappearing. Well, Bigfoot's really fast. Like, come on, guys. Come on, not that kind of disappearing. Well, it just looked like it disappeared. No, it really disappeared, you know. Mm-hmm. I get tired of people not being intellectually honest about those sort of things. Yeah. Not witnesses, researchers would say that.
Right. Yeah. Oh yeah. There is a story, and you mentioning that just reminded me of it. Do either of you remember, and it might have been Charles Fort that initially reported this, about a single pair of hoof prints that went through a New England town?
Yeah. Oh, man. I wish I could remember the name of that particular case.
But it's like, it was like the devil's footprints or something.
And there were one in front of the other, as I recall.
This isn't the Jersey Devil?
No.
Okay.
No. I'm seeing if I can find it here.
I remember reading about it in some kind of like Paper's Digest, company weird stuff.
These, here we are. These footprints jumped onto roofs of houses and went through.
Sort of
like those family circus cartoons where you see where the kid goes all around the neighborhood.
Yeah.
It says the devil's footprints were a phenomenon that occurred in February 1855 around XA or EXE. How would you say that? It's English.
Exeter?
And it's just EXE, estuary in East Devon and South Devon, England. After a heavy snowfall, trails of hoof-like marks appeared overnight in the snow, covering a total distance of some 40 to 100 miles. The footprints were so-called because some people believe that they were the tracks of Satan, as they were alleged to be made by a cloven hoof. Many theories have been put forward to explain the incident, and some aspects of its veracity have also been called into question. Of course, I mean, it's all going to be...
Yeah.
Interpretation and so on and so forth. It appears on so this is from a news report. It appears on Thursday night last, there was a very heavy snowfall in the neighborhood of Exeter and south of Devon. On the following morning, the inhabitants of the above towns were surprised at discovering the footmarks of some strange and mysterious animal endowed with the power of ubiquity, as the footprints were seen in all kinds of unaccountable places, on the tops of houses and narrow walls, in gardens and courtyards, enclosed by high walls and palings, as well as in open fields.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, why?
Exactly. And yes, they were single file. They were not like an animal would normally walk that's bipedal or bipedal or walking on four legs.
Unless you're a fashion model or walking down the runway.
Right. Maybe it's somebody from the future playing a prank.
Yeah, I don't think it was some of the explanations at the time, as I recall, were that it was a rabbit or something.
A kangaroo.
Yeah.
An experimental balloon.
Of course, the old experimental balloon.
It says, author Jeffrey Household suggested that an experimental balloon released by mistake from Devonport Dockyard had left the mysterious tracks by trailing two shackles on the end of its mooring ropes.
Well, that always happens whenever I have an experimental balloon.
Hopping mice, hysteria, kangaroo. Badgers. Yeah.
Okay, so let's see what can we learn from this. Let's assume that this was the result of something. This was a deliberate event created by a non-human force.
Mm-hmm.
What? Why?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I mean, other than just to mess with people.
We talk so much about like the individual being the one that is benefiting from the event, the focus of the event. Why? I mean, and I guess if I could just sort of jump in, like maybe when we have something like that that's over a community, we sort of think that maybe it's meant for the whole community, but maybe it was just meant for one person and we never found out what that event meant for them, you know?
Sure. Maybe it had a very profound effect on one person.
Yep.
And it just completely altered their entire life and everything else. And to everyone else, it was just, and even to them, they may not have known what it was, but it just had that strong effect on them. It's entirely possible. You could be dead on there. And maybe they're the only real person in the world.
I don't know. I still keep thinking that these events are designed with a certain level of absurdity, because confusion, by rendering people into a level of confusion, it preps them to a certain mental mode in which new information can be imparted.
Yep.
Well, you know, a counselor told me once that we like to think of our lives being the most productive when we're on the base of our triangle. So if you imagine a triangle with one of the points upwards and lying along one of its flat sides, but it really is when your life is on the tip as opposed to the flat side where things are destabilized, but there's the most room for change.
Yep.
Well, here's the other thing. We look at this phenomena as if it's one thing. And I think that's just our nature. What if some of, I mean, obviously we talk about, well, some of it could be bad, some of it could be good, but maybe this was just some other that's going, ha, watch this. And there's nothing else to it. It was just going, it was just there to play a joke.
Sure. I mean, makes sense
to me. And watch us freak out.
It makes perfect sense to me because humor, I think it's a fundamental part of intelligence. You know, like so that, yeah. Imagine an intelligence that is, you know, far more advanced than us, and also far older. You know, to a being like that, you know, the universe will be completely devoid of any interest, because you know there's no more mysteries to solve, you know. So the only thing to do in order to complete, you know, cosmic boredom will be to try to, you know, trick the walking apes on planet Earth, you know.
Well, you know, I think you've really hit on something there, Miguel, because if you think about most of the intelligent people that I know, those who are socially capable are usually pretty funny people.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, pranksters.
Right, exactly. And, you know, it's almost like it's a means of expressing intelligence. Like, puns and witticisms are a way of sort of approaching these answers from around the other side. You know, it's almost like coming at the... It's almost like displaying intelligence from around, you know, from a different angle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's playing with things.
Yeah, exactly. And we know for a fact, you know, science has demonstrated that play, it's a necessity in higher mammals, you know, and animals with a high level of emotional and intelligence complexity.
Right. And it still could be one thing. I mean, we could be dealing with one singular intelligence that has many sides to it. I do believe that was Paul Kimball's idea, is that it was one intelligence wearing different masks.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know me, I like that as much as anybody else, especially with all the connections that I'm always seeing between things. Yeah, but also we need to sort of... maybe our definition of one needs to be deconstructed a little bit here. I mean, like, maybe it could be one thing and many things, you know. It could be the fingers on a hand, or it could be, you know, different sides of the dodecahedron. You know, many things and one thing at once.
Look at bees. You know, bees seem to be individuals, but they also seem to have a hive mind.
Yeah.
Right.
And everyone's familiar with that. So, I mean, we could be dealing with an other that works much the same way. And you get that description in Alien Abduction Accounts, that it seems like they're working on a hive mind. I just don't trust anything you come away with from any of this stuff, like, as data. You know, because if that's the case, then these things are from every planet in the solar system and many others. And, you know, the world's already going to have ended and this and that. So, I mean, them seeming like they have a hive mind could just be another game, another misdirection.
Yeah.
Yes.
Stroking my beard.
Finding patterns in this stuff that mean something is the hardest part because we don't know what we're dealing with.
Sure, and we also don't know whether we are deluding ourselves, you know, connecting dots where there are no really not dots, any dots to connect.
And the things that matter to human beings are, you know, also not perhaps the things that matter, you know,
to intelligence. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And if there is something with bloodlines or blood types, I mean, the obvious question would be why? What makes that different? And what else does it say about us? I mean, would there, if we could prove that certain blood types or certain bloodlines have these paranormal experiences and others don't, would there be some sort of, one way or the other, some sort of cry of racism whenever someone pointed it out?
I was about to say it's ripe for racist hijacking. I suspect personally that it has less to do with like racial heritage and more to do because I mean again you got to look at the survey sample. Brazil is one of the most paranormal countries on the planet. How many Brazilians did they get? You know,
right? Of course,
there's a lot of German heritage in Brazil, so don't get me wrong with that.
Well, yes, yeah.
But
you know, are neo-Nazis going to take something like this and be like, see, we are the preferred race, you know?
I can see some idiot doing that, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Or you could construe it that, you know, to this intelligence, you know, neo-Nazis are akin to rats, right? And they don't go after the others because they like them more, like, you know, the same way humans prefer dogs over rats.
Or maybe when Hitler was doing all his different experiments in the occult, they contacted something. And these things can only see the people who contacted them. You know, or they're more, you know, depending on what kind of sense they have, what, you know, I mean, we think of everything as being visual unless we're blind. It just seems to be our default sense is our eyes.
Yeah.
And so we think, well, you know, they're looking at us like we would look at a rabbit in the field, but it may not be anything like that. Their senses could be so completely different, and who knows how they're looking at us. And if something in our blood is slightly different, slightly more or less that we don't even know to look for, and those people made themselves very apparent to these things, maybe they know how to tune into it.
Well, and again, I'll also say, you know, what if the paranormal entities are like race car drivers and they're just looking for the biggest engine, you know? And maybe special one particular blood type is the V8, you know?
Could be.
I don't know if we discussed this on a previous roundtable, but this concept that Whitley Strieber wrote about in his blog about how visitors, he put the example of a visitor looking into a tree, and the visitor wouldn't be looking at the tree the same way that we humans look at it, because they are not stuck or bound by time the same way we are. So they will look at the tree and they will see both the tree as it is right now, but also the seed from which it germinated, and also even, you know, the wood that it will become, you know, after it was like cut down by a logger or something. Everything at the same time, you know, everything as some kind of continuum.
That's brings to mind the way Keel would try to explain multidimensional entities and saying that, you know, if we lived in a two-dimensional world and someone put their finger down into it, it would just seem to appear from nowhere. We'd have no concept of what we were looking at. And when they lifted their finger up, even though we realized that, yes, the finger was moving up, they have no concept of up, so it just disappeared.
Yep, yeah, yep.
And they're on another level than we are, so when they put our finger down in our reality, they just appear and we go, what the hell is that? And then they take it away and we went, no, I didn't get a picture. You look at some of these missing 411 cases. Have either of you read the books?
I have read Western Edition a long time ago.
Have you read anything?
No, I haven't had the chance yet.
So what strikes me about them is that it totally could be someone wandering into something totally natural, a portal, or some of them, not all of them. It could be numerous things going on, like with any of this phenomena. In the stuff I'm going to be talking to Steph Young about soon, she has a number of cases where people, I'm trying to remember what the one is. These kids wandered somewhere and ended up somewhere they never saw before. And they were all like, oh, this is great. Where are we? But they were kids. They didn't realize there was anything really wrong. And people were looking for them. They couldn't find them. And suddenly they just showed up. And, you know, they asked them where they went. And they went, well, we were down this trail and we were doing this and that. And they're like, there's nothing down that trail. This stuff doesn't exist. It turns out there was a tiger walking along in that area. And she speculates, you know, did something move these kids out of danger and then put them back after the tiger was gone? So it's... We know so little about this stuff. I mean, we think we do, especially some people think they know everything about this stuff when it comes to UFOs and so on and so forth. But we honestly know so little. It's hard to even guess sometimes what we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have like 1% of the puzzle, and some people think we have 100. For instance, David Jacobs.
Yeah.
But you look at this stuff, and, you know, we're throwing around these ideas, and it's hard to pin any of them down. Like, I think the Project Core is a good start, a good baby step forward to try and create a pattern.
Yep.
But what else can we do? What else do you think we can do to kind of pin something down? What can we pin down?
I think the only answer I could provide right now is to try to change the mental processes of human beings, you know, maybe by changing our mental processes, we will perceive both the world and maybe, you know, the things that go, you know, beyond our, the range of reality in a different light, you know, maybe, I don't know, we are right now, as it is, you know, through our modern technology, changing both the way we perceive the world, the way we retain our memories, the way we gather and absorb information. Who knows if that will also change the way that we experience paranormal events, the way we seem to interact or respond to manifestations of these other intelligence.
Joshua?
Yeah, to not... just waiting for everybody to be silent. you know, without trying to get too zen and at the same time oversimplified about it, I think that we really need to start asking ourselves, instead of trying to look for the answer, we need to really start thinking if we're asking the right questions. And that's part of what Project Core was on its way towards stepping. But what I mean by that even more so is we should be asking deeper philosophical questions that don't seem like they have any reason to layer over this paranormal phenomena. You know, somebody seeing a light in the sky that zips off might not be a profound experience, but perhaps if we overlay the idea and work backwards from the idea that it was a profound experience, perhaps that might give us some extra insight. I still don't think that we're asking the right questions, and they need to be just let's just, you know, throw stuff off the wall. I'm stealing a little bit from Greg Bishop here, but like, let's just pull stuff off the wall that doesn't seem like it should have any real bearing on this, and see if there's maybe some sort of trend that emerges.
I think what you did with your book was very good.
Oh,
because
shucks.
you're looking at patterns that other people haven't looked at before.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, part of me wanted to say that, but I didn't want to, because I just said that a couple of shows ago with Tim Benal. But yeah, I think they're looking at the little deep. I think they're looking at the stupidest stuff is going to be our escape valve. I really do.
And I think there's slowly developing two main fields of thought with this stuff. You have the traditional method, which is all this stuff is separate and it's exactly what it seems like.
Yep.
And then you have the people, like what's growing field of people saying, maybe it's all interconnected. Even people like Brad Steiger, who did not think this stuff was interconnected at one point, came out with was it his latest book? I think it was his latest book where he started calling it The Other and saying, you know, it's all connected. It's all the same phenomena.
Yeah, and I would like to think I'm trying to fact check my or to gut check myself here. I think that maybe it might be a little bit of both. I think that people like me who are constantly screaming at the top of their lungs, it's all connected, might only have part of the answer as well. I think, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Aspects of it are all connected, and some aspects are not connected at all. So just trying
What your book showed was the connections between, say, the different types of abduction scenario, whether it be fairy faith or alien, you know, looking like aliens or whatever face it was wearing. But it did not show a connection to the Bigfoot thing.
Yeah, it was a looser connection than it looks like at first. Yeah, that's definitely true.
Yeah, maybe what connects all these things together is only human consciousness. I mean, this is something that I mentioned at one point during a roundtable at the Paradigm Symposium in 2014. That, you know, all these things are part of our culture because they were experienced at one point or another by a human being, you know, and then you come up with some kind of wacky zing kind of questions, you know, if a UFO is flying over Washington but nobody goes looks up, you know, to see it, you know, is it still there?
Yeah.
And I will stand in line behind you on that any day of the week. Absolutely.
And our reality may be reactive to our beliefs.
Yep.
You know, that whole, as Miguel puts it, the co-creative aspect. And if it is reactive, then no matter what we think, that's what it's going to look like.
Well, and any self-respecting chaos magician would agree with you 100% on that.
Yep. Yes. And that's a great thing about chaos magic. It breaks down those assumptions. It's like one of the weirdest things I found getting into chaos magic is that at first I found I was practicing chaos magic without knowing what it was. I was just doing my thing and then came across, you know, the term and was like, oh, wait, that's what I do. And then I found people trying to structure it. And it's like, no, you can't put structure in the thing that's like primarily anti-structural.
Exactly. Putting structure into chaos. I mean, come on.
The whole point is that it's anti-structural. There are no specific rules. You use what works for you, and you imbue these things with power. And, you know, when you start writing down rules, it's like it's not chaos magic anymore.
Yeah, exactly. It's corporate magic.
There was a volume called Liber Null and Psychonaut, and Carol, I can't remember the guy's first name, his last name was Carol, wrote it. And one of the books, and I don't remember which one, in this two-volume set was great. It talked about chaos magic and the basic principles and stuff, and I read it and went, that was fantastic. And then I read the other half, and the other half was all about putting structure into chaos magic. And I'm like, okay, well, the first book was good. but same author, you know, and it's like, I think what it is you can't write that much about it because it is so anti-structural.
Yep.
You know, you could write a billion books on Wicca, because there's all kinds of stuff you can write about that's Wicca, and this is Wicca, and that's Wicca. But with chaos magic, that's not the case. So how do you make money off of it?
Right. Well, I think that you could probably write about... The thing that I've been thinking about a lot lately is how chaos magicians choose targets. And I think you can write about, like, advice...
Yes.
Advice that reinforces, or rather advice that works in sync with the chaotic nature of it, if that makes any sense.
No, it does.
Yeah, well,
does.
Maybe that's what Icelanders have been doing for hundreds of years, you know, when they decide not to tear down the boulders where the faithful live.
Yeah.
It's
one way to look at it.
The episode there of what was it? Expanded Universe.
Expanded Perspectives.
Expanded Perspectives.
Hi, Cam actually, and Kyle.
Yeah,
that was the first episode I listened to with the trolls. Thanks to you, Joshua, because you recommended checking them out.
Thanks.
And I enjoyed it. And you know, and they're talking about it. They kept talking about Troll Hunter, and you know what? That's a great movie. Have either of you seen that?
I have, yeah.
Never reached Mexico.
Really?
No, I don't think so.
It's one of those found footage type of movies. Mm-hmm. And it's done exceptionally well. And it takes on that mythology and stuff. And but they related in that episode a lot of very varied stories. And as they were saying themselves, they don't know if they're true because they're just, you know... They went onto the internet and searched out troll stories.
Mm-hmm.
But so many of them rang true to fairy faith type stories as well. I mean, they're different. It seems like the culture puts a different twist on these things. Mm. But when you dig down to the core, the skeleton of it is still very, very similar, whether it be the djinn or the fairy faith or trolls or, what's the ones over here in New England?
Puckwudgies.
Yeah, Puckwudgies.
Yep.
And you're like, that name itself is just great. but they all behave the same, even though they all look differently. They all seem like they're different things.
Well, it almost strikes me as sort of a syncretic mythology in and of itself. Because, I mean, again, we've talked about how, you know, Bigfoot is a lot like a Woodwose in Celtic folklore. And we've talked about how greys are a lot like, well, rather alien phenomena is a lot like fairy folk as well. But you look at the lore of the British Isles, and it's also tied up in the dead. It's also tied up in ghosts. Like half of the stories where someone's warned to not eat or drink in fairyland is because they see a dead relative or a dead neighbor warning them at the party. So again, I think this is all sort of, that's another thing that gives me some clues personally as to the fact that these things might all be sort of describing at least aspects of a similar phenomena at work.
And in the end, we don't understand any of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
All right. Any last thoughts, guys?
Keep on asking questions that don't seem relevant. That's my last bit of advice.
Mm. Before we try to understand the bigger mysteries out there, maybe we should start trying to understand the little mysteries inside of us.
Nice.
Perfect.
All right. So I guess that concludes this week's midweek podcast. This is where the sidewalk ended. And Josh, Mike, and myself will be at Fort Fest this coming weekend on June 12th.
I'm not going to join you.
June 11th and 12th.
All right. And that's down in Maryland. So if you're going to be there, come talk to us. We'd love to talk to you. And it should be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to be talking about, Joshua?
It's going to be sort of a primer to the subject of my book, but it's going to have some visual aids, which is something that I didn't get to do in the book at all. So,
really, are you bringing your tuba?
No. I don't want to check it, man. I'm going to buy a seat for it.
I will be talking about some of my experiences, and this week I'm going to go out and get some pictures at some of the locations that things happen. So at least I have some visual stuff there that will, I think, make it a little more interesting.
And Mike Hughes will be there as well. So if you're a fan of the Midweek Podcast, come by and say hey to almost the whole gang. Almost the whole
yes. And Mike will be talking about the tarot, I believe.
Yes. Mm,
nice.
All right. Thank you so much, guys. We'll talk soon.
All right, take care.
Have fun in Fortfest.